I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief at Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today I've got with me our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
Hi, Jordan. And our editor-at-large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
Hello, Jamie. Long time
no
hear. So this week we'll be taking a look at Woody Allen's controversial A Rainy Day in New York, Simon Bird's directorial debut Days of Bagnall Summer, and Irish comedy Dating Amber. And as Days of Bagnall Summer and Dating Amber deal with adolescent angst, we'll be testing your teen movie knowledge with our weekly film quiz. Okay, so first, boys, though, let's answer a reader's question. And the question is, which movies turned out better than the book and which movies didn't? Jamie, you must have a load of these.
Not a load. I mean, in terms of movies that have turned out better than the book, I don't know if there's a load that I can think of. I mean, you know I'm a bit of a horror fan, so I'll go for a couple of horror movies that immediately spring to mind. I think Carrie, the Brian De Palma 1976 film, is better than Stephen King's debut novel. The novel was kind of told from many different perspectives. It's a kind of collage treatment that you've got newspaper reports, interviews, sort of all different hopping around to get the kind of many angled look at this girl with telekinetic powers and everything that happened to her. I mean, it's got a lot of energy and it's gory and you can see why it really caught the imagination, but I don't think it's one of King's better novels, and it's very kind of bitty. And then De Palma took that and turned it into this amazing horror film where, you know, all of his technique, all of his camera moves, you know, he's just a wonderful suspense director, and I think it's one of, if not De Palma's best film. I'd immediately say that. I also think that Hitchcock's Psycho is better than Robert Bloch's novel, which Hitchcock basically streamlined the novel quite a bit. Let's just say Robert Bloch is not the best writer in the world. If you read it, it's a little bit clunky. And again, you can see why it's such a famous book. It's kind of really had an impact. And Marion Crane is even decapitated in the shower. So it's really kind of for its time, it's really out there and gory and grisly. But I think Hitchcock's film is a far more kind of sophisticated effort in a way. Mm-hmm. So I'll go with those two to start us off.
What about you, Jordan?
I would go with Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? And that's not because I don't like the book. I'm a huge Philip K. Dick fan. He's one of my favorite authors. And I think the book has a lot of merits, but Blade Runner is just a stone cold masterpiece and distills sort of the key themes of that book in a much more interesting way for me. A lot of the book isn't dedicated to Deckard. Like, you don't follow him for a lot of the novel. And all that stuff is really interesting when you're reading it on the page, but it would have just been distracting on screen. And I think they did the right thing doing what they did, stripping it down, making it about this pure chase movie, basically, with philosophical underpinnings.
Isn't that kind of true of quite a lot of Philip K. Dick books? You know, like Minority Report, it sort of took it and ran with it in a much sort of larger way. But I'm going to throw in the mix Jaws, because I think that the book of Jaws is much more layered and Spielberg streamlined those characters. I prefer what Spielberg did with it, and I prefer the fact it's so taut and sharp and it does exactly what you don't expect it to do. It's much better than the book. And I remember, I obviously read the book after the film and was horribly disappointed when I read the book. It wasn't what I thought it was at all. So that would be my choice.
I have to say, Jamie, I was shocked that you didn't pick Stand By Me / The Body. Is that the technicality of it not technically being a novel? Or
Well, it's a novella, but it's not that. I've actually got a few where I think the story and the film are absolutely tremendous and kind of match each other. And that is one of them. I actually think The Body is one of the best things Stephen King has ever written. It's very personal. It's, the prose is just so kind of colourful and it takes you right back to that summer with those boys. And then you all know what I think of Stand By Me, the film. Yes. It's like my favourite film
ever.
How
many times have you watched it, Jamie?
111.
111.
I know. But only about 11 times in the last 15 years. I've really slowed down. It was all in my youth. I watched it again and again and again. And then I think there's other books. Like, I think Lord of the Rings trilogy is tremendous and the films are tremendous. No Country for Old Men and the Coen Brothers adaptation. Mm-hmm. Fight Club, the book, and Fight Club, the film are great. Rum Punch by Elmore Leonard, and then obviously Jackie Brown, the adaptation by Tarantino, which also gave it a sort of blaxploitation vibe by turning the heroine into a black American lady, played by Pam Grier. So you've got all of the kind of coffee and the history of, you know, blaxploitation in the movie. I think they're both absolutely great. So there's a lot that I think match it, but not that many where you can really say the film surpasses the book.
I have two I would put forward. The Shining, a controversial one.
I agree.
And and The Godfather as well, which, you know, yeah, Mario Puzo was involved in the film as well, but everything about the film is just much better than the book.
Yeah, agree. I think The Shining, the movie, I much prefer that to the book.
I prefer the book.
Well, I know you do. We know how you feel about Stephen King, Jamie.
You fanboy.
Yeah.
I am. Jane, am I right in saying, because it's years since I read Jaws, but doesn't the book focus a lot more as like a whole subplot of the chief's wife having an affair?
Yeah. There's a massive
affair. Yeah, which is all strict for the film.
Yeah, and it works so much better when she is the wife that you see in that film. And she's by no means just the wife. She's very complex and everything else that's going on in that film. But without this weird affair that she has in the book with Matt Hooper, it's a very strange dimension to it. Whereas it's far better when it's literally about those three men and not that dynamic on that boat. And it's the men against the men against the fish. So yeah, it's much better. And also, I'm just going to throw it in there before we finish this. You know which one I'm going to say.
I was going to bring this up, but you go ahead.
Call Me By Your Name.
The film is
far better than the book, where in the book they sort of poo in front of each other because they love each other so much. And there's a lot of sort of flowery prose, shall we say. And I feel like it was distilled to its just lovely essence by James Ivory, the screenplay that actually makes it a better story. Okay, let's draw a line under that before I start banging on even further about that film, because we know how much I love that. So let's stop before Jamie carries on about, you know, Stephen King, and Jordan carries on about androids who dream of sheep, and I do that one. Let's move on to films that are actually out now that we can see. Let's take a look at this one and talk about the elephant that's in the room with the 48th movie from Woody Allen.
I got an interview with Roland Pollard.
Oh my gosh, that is amazing. And it's on campus?
Mm-mm. It's in Manhattan.
We're always talking about going into Manhattan for a special weekend. This is going to be absolutely fantastic.
Later, maybe we could take a carriage ride.
Yeah.
If it doesn't rain.
So that's A Rainy Day in New York from Woody Allen. Not without its controversy. Jamie, what is it about? And obviously, why is it controversial?
Well, it starts off, it's set at Yardley College, which is a fictional college, and there's a character called Gatsby, of all things, played by Timothée Chalamet, and Ashley, played by Elle Fanning, who's his girlfriend. Ashley works for the college paper, and she scores a big interview with a top director who's a kind of existential art house director called Roland Pollard, played by Liev Schreiber. So she has to go off into Manhattan to conduct this interview. And the boyfriend, Gatsby, says, oh, I'll come along with you and we'll make a weekend of it, because he grew up in Manhattan. He knows all the sights. And he says, you know, we'll have a lovely romantic weekend, do a bit of sightseeing, etc. And then once they get to Manhattan, all of his plans go askew because Ashley keeps having to work and like the interview gets put back and it gets sort of messed around. So she keeps having to dedicate her time to doing the work. And then the Gatsby character starts to get very paranoid that something's going on. Like, is she having an affair? And basically all the men in this film, there's several older men. There's Roland Pollard, the director. There's a worldwide movie star played by Diego Luna. Mm-hmm. As Jude Law plays the writer of Roland Pollard's latest film. And all of these guys kind of become obsessed with her, even though she's just a college girl. You know, they're all kind of, oh, she's wonderful. She's so intoxicating. So we kind of seen that in Woody's work many times over the years. And obviously it's very controversial in this day and age since the Time's Up movement kind of came into play. All of those old allegations against Woody Allen and, you know, his adopted daughter and the whole sort of Dylan Farrow sexual abuse allegations that first reared their head in, I think it was, well, it was around about the time of Husbands and Wives, so it would have been early 90s, and it's kind of been dogging him ever since, but now it's really come to the fore. So obviously for him to go out and make a film like this, which many would say has got a real tin ear, but it's completely tone deaf to our times, it's very controversial.
Almost like a screw you, like I'll continue to make the films I want to with dippy women that are so intoxicating to older men because they're stupid. That seemed to be the message I was getting. Like, I think you're amazing because you're so stupid. I could manipulate you to take your clothes off and get into bed with me. And that was kind of a nasty taste in the mouth for me.
The trouble is, I mean, it's almost like he's baiting people. I mean, you could just say that he refuses to change and, you know, he's going to make the movies he wants to make. It's almost like he invented this genre with the kind of pseudo-intellectual chatter and all of these characters who, like, you know, Gatsby in this film, even though he's only 21 or 22, he has a cigarette holder and he wears tweed and he listens to Cocktail Piano, and it's so Woody Allen.
And he's insufferable.
He's never going to change. He is insufferable. But it's like Woody Allen, there's lines in this film, like there's one point where the Gatsby character, he bumps into this young kid sister of a girl he used to date, who's played by Selena Gomez in the film. And then he starts sort of having a, well, you could call it an affair because he's gotten a girlfriend, but he starts seeing her during this film. And he says, oh, you know, she was a kid sister and she always was sexually advanced. And then there's another line in the film where the Chalamet character says, what is it about older guys that's so appealing to women? So given everything that's gone down in the last few years, you'd really think, like, why would Woody Allen have his character saying things like this? It's almost like stoking the fire or poking the hornet's nest. There are moments in this film I felt very, very uncomfortable.
What about you, Jordan?
I completely agree, even apart from the fact that I found it's, completely tone deaf. Yeah, seemingly being a middle finger up to Me Too and Time's Up and all those important movements. I just found the film itself just like really insufferable and wooden, no pun intended, not like remotely amusing or charming, just nothing about it appealed to me in sort of any way. I'm not surprised that half of the actors that are in this film have disowned it beyond the fact that it's directed by Woody Allen, because Timothée Chalamet, he must be embarrassed to have this performance out in the world, because I think it's by far one of his worst performances.
It's like he's sort of doing an impression of Woody himself, very sort of mannered way of speaking, the sort of gesticulation. It's like he's sort of an avatar for him. When it started, it's quite jarring to watch, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, this happens with a lot of Woody's films. You know, Jesse Eisenberg in Cafe Society, for example, he's basically just playing a Woody Allen cipher. But it didn't feel like this character needed to be that. And I don't know why Timothy plays it that way. But the result is you just can't stand to be in his company.
He does have considerable on-screen charm, just the Chalamet. But even he cannot make this person seem quirky or cute or sort of eccentrically charming. He's just annoying, isn't he?
I've always been a big Woody Allen fan in the past, you know, and I think some of his work in the 70s and 80s is absolutely extraordinary. But the run he's on at the moment, it just feels like he's someone turning circles and he's a man out of time. And, you know, he's made 48 films now, and you've got to wonder, will he get to 50? It does seem like, you know, every couple of years there's another nail in the coffin, so we will see.
Well, it was a real struggle for him to even get this one out. I mean, it was made, what, 2 years ago, I think, now, and has basically been on the shelf, certainly in terms of the UK release, for well over a year. I'm surprised it's even coming out, to be honest, because I can't think of a worse time to be releasing a film like this.
Amazon declined it, didn't they? Because they've got a contract with Woody Allen, or they did have a contract with Woody Allen. You know, they released his TV show, which was really just a film in 6 parts, each part about 22 minutes, but he didn't do anything different. It was just a 90-minute Woody Allen movie spread over 6 parts. But then he made this, and with everything going on and, you know, all of the criticism aimed at Woody Allen, they've then declined it. So where that leaves Woody Allen in terms of getting distribution, I mean, he's more popular in Europe, and he always has been more popular in Europe than he is in America. So I imagine there will always be people somewhere in Europe who will fund his films, and there's still festivals who take his films and think it's a real kind of a jewel in the crown to have one of his movies in your festival. So he probably will potter along and carry on as he does one movie a year. But it does feel, I hate to say it, being an old Woody Allen fan back in the day, but I feel like his time has been and gone, really do.
Are there any pluses?
I thought Elle Fanning had a charm. She is something of a magnetic presence on screen, and you can absolutely see why Woody would cast her in that role. I don't think the character was great at all, but as a performer, I thought she made more of it than what was on the page.
And Selena Gomez, she's sort of the one sort of person who seems to be able to carry off these lines and you believe them rather than you can see them written on the script. She actually delivers these snarky sort of put downs with that sort of husky voice of hers, and she is actually properly charming. But again, not a great role, just this girl that you know, does ridiculous things like gets soaking wet and goes and gets changed into a smaller outfit for a rainy day. Just these sort of things are just irritating beyond belief. And yeah, and as you said with Elle Fanning, the whole idea that she's this journalist, but she turns up to an interview with a major director with a tiny pad and pen, no recording equipment, and doesn't take a single note. That sort of thing is just really infuriating.
Yeah, if that was me, I'd have three dictaphones and a packet of spare batteries in my pocket.
And the iPhone going, the whole shebang. Yeah. And so it's just, it's sort of generally, I found the whole thing insulting to my intelligence and to anyone's intelligence.
To go back to what you were saying about leading men often kind of aping Woody Allen in the films, and it goes right back, like Kenneth Branagh did it in Celebrity, you know, so many of them do. And it's a strange one because Woody Allen always says, and his actors always say, he never gives that instruction. In fact, he doesn't give any instructions to actors. So he never says, like, oh, play it like, you know, it's me in Manhattan or me in Annie Hall, you know, this is my persona. It must just be something in the writing, in the rhythm of the writing, where they take it on and they know his old work and they just do it. But like you said, Jane, the reason Selena Gomez kind of stands out in this film is she doesn't do it. She doesn't take on that pattern of the writing. She makes it believable. She brings an authenticity that feels quite modern to it rather than these characters stuck in a period drama, because even though it's set in the present day, you know, it may as well be like 40s New York.
Yeah, people might as well be going, swell. Okay, so are we going to recommend this? Is it a curiosity worth watching? And maybe should we even be watching it? Can we separate the artist from the art?
The only reason to watch it is if you're a Woody Allen completist. Otherwise, I would give it a wide berth.
I agree. I think Woody Allen has made worse films. I don't think this is an absolute stinker like some of his films in the last 15 years have been. I think it looks very beautiful, like Vittorio Storaro is a director of photography who's done his last few films, and, you know, he shoots Central Park and the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and, you know, they all look wonderful, and it has some of those Woody Allen one-liners. So if you're a completist, like Jordan said, a diehard Woody Allen fan, there are things in there for you, but anyone else, I think, should maybe swerve it.
Okay, so that's A Rainy Day in New York, which is available from Friday the 5th of June on all digital platforms. Should we move from New York then to somewhere decidedly less glamorous? Let's take a look at this.
So, Sue, is Daniel enjoying his summer holidays?
Not really. He was meant to be visiting his father in Florida. But let's just say Bob isn't the most reliable.
Hello. I'm afraid you're stuck with boring old me for 6 weeks. But we'll have fun.
Sorry to hear about his trip. Daniel seems quite philosophical about it all, though.
I don't want to be here, do I? I want to be in Florida, where I'm supposed to be, with Dad.
I think he's quite disappointed, to be honest.
OK, so this is Days of Bagnall Summer. Jamie, you were on set of this.
I was.
Tell us what this is about.
Well, it's based on a 2012 graphic novel by Geoff Winterhart. It's not a graphic novel like you may think in terms of the kind of Marvel ones. This is an economic comic book. It's kind of just backgrounds are plain. There's not much dialogue in it. And it's about these two characters, a middle-aged mother and a teenage son, who are stuck together over the summer. The boy, called Daniel, is meant to be going away to Florida for the summer to spend it with his dad and his new girlfriend. It gets cancelled last minute, so he's stuck at home in the suburbs in England with his librarian mother, who's a real fuss pot, always kind of on his case. He's a metaller. He just wants to sit in his room, blast out heavy metal. He's kind of very sulky and stroppy. And then over the course of the summer, they just gradually reconnect and build a kind of friendship again. Now, what I really liked about this movie is most coming-of-age movies just focus on the teenager. This one gives equal time to Sue, the mother, Daniel, the teenage son. You really get to know both the characters. You really feel for them. It's a very sort of steady, subdued, quiet interior film. You know, don't expect rockets, spaceships, anything like that. I found it really affecting. And as it went on, I kind of really fell in love with these two characters.
And also, you probably connected to it because it was basically a biography of you, Jamie, as a teenager.
Yeah, in terms of...
Sitting in your room, listening to metal.
I was a stroppy metaller, there's no doubt of that, yeah.
That's just every teenage boy, though. I was a stroppy new metaller, which is slightly embarrassing.
Did you connect to it, Jordan?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, there was a lot I could recognize in the way Daniel behaved. That sort of irrational belief that one person is the root of all your problems and that you're not addressing the deeper issues there. Those like long summers that you would have where you would be stuck at home and there would be seemingly nothing to do. Although I look back on those summers now and think I never had it better. I had no pressures. I could just do whatever I wanted.
Just had a bike and your pocket money and you were off.
Exactly. I found a lot to like with this film. You know, knowing Simon Bird, the director, for his work on The Inbetweeners, I think I was sort of expecting something slightly different going in, something a bit more in tune with that show's kind of more acerbic, rude sense of humor. But it was actually a lot warmer and a lot sort of sweeter than I was expecting. Both Earl Cave, who plays Daniel, and Monica Dolan, who plays Sue, the mum, they're both such warm performers, even beyond Daniel's sort of regular strops. I felt like I really started to care about them quite quickly and just wanted them to get along.
Oh, I like you, Jordan. I was sort of expecting something maybe a bit saucy and raucous like The Inbetweeners, but it's actually quite gentle and sitcom-y and sort of shares DNA more with sort of Adrian Mole than The Inbetweeners or Submarine or something like that. This sort of awkward boy trapped in suburbia and this sort of very beige British sort of world. Everything's beige apart from his black t-shirts. There's that lovely shot in the garden where she's hanging out the washing and the sort of loads of beige clothes for her and then all of his black t-shirts. It is extremely gentle, and that won't be for everybody, will it?
It won't. I mean, when I was on set in Bromley, which was a very sort of quiet suburban street in the house where they live in the film, Simon Bird was saying to me that all of that tone, it comes from the graphic novel, but it also comes from the movies that he grew up loving that are his favourite films, which are kind of 70s American comedies, character comedies. So it's stuff like Paper Moon by Peter Bogdanovich, Harold and Maude by Hal Ashley, Heartbreak Kid by Elaine May. And they don't really make those kind of films anymore. And that's what he wanted. He wanted to go back and do an English equivalent of these kind of sad, poignant comedies that came out of America in the 70s. If you are looking for more recent versions or kind of equivalents, then maybe stuff like Rushmore, Welcome to the Dollhouse, Squid and the Whale. It's that kind of tone. And I don't think that Days of Bagnold Summer is of the quality of any of those films I've just mentioned, because they are all wonderful, wonderful films. But I think for a directorial debut, low budget, British kind of suburbs movie, which you don't really get any of those, I think it shows a lot of promise. And Simon Bird is definitely someone to watch.
And the script is written by his wife, Lisa Owens. That's right, so it's a family affair.
You also get a lot of recognisable faces in supporting roles. So you've got people like Rob Brydon playing this kind of lecherous teacher who hits on Sue in the library, and Tamsin Gregg as this sort of well-to-do mother, and Tim Key as this fudge shop salesman who puts on a fudge making demonstration, which is remarkably awkward. And these sort of punctuate the film with these really, really quite funny comedy skits almost.
Yeah. I mean, he's not known. He's a newcomer, but I loved Elliot Speller-Gillett as Daniel's best friend, Kai, who's like this really posh rocker. I just thought he was really good value for money. You know, there's a key dog scene, which you two must have found difficult to watch with your doggy friends beside you.
Of course.
Yeah. That dog was lovely.
Actually, just to get a bit personal here, but the scene where Rob Brydon's character, the teacher, goes out on a date with Daniel's mum, which obviously Daniel hates, you know, he just curls up in a ball of rage and embarrassment. I could really identify with that because my dad actually dated my maths teacher when I was a teenager. When I was a teenager, yes. My parents divorced when I was 11 and when I was about 14. Not for long, only a couple of dates, but he started seeing my maths teacher. And one day I came home from school in the evening. I'd been around with friends and they were just sat in the front room watching TV together. And then the next day I was in maths being told off by her. So that was absolutely horrendous.
Jamie.
So you basically, you lived Bagnold Summer.
Yeah, though. This is your film.
This is my film. This is why I've connected with it. Someone's finally made a movie about me. It's great.
Were you in a band, Jamie, when you were a kid?
I was in a band, but none of us could play instruments and none of us could sing.
That's okay. It didn't stop Bill and Ted.
We called the band Lycanthrope because we thought we were very clever. We were all into horror films and we thought, oh, not many people our age will know what that is. And we all said we were going to buy electric guitars and become a major band, and then none of us ever did it. But we did go around telling people we were in a band for about 2 years. So that was good.
This isn't Jamie's like on the couch confessions. We are still,
I don't know,
inside Total Film. But maybe there'll be more. There may be more. So let's just wrap this up. Would we recommend this as a film to watch?
I most certainly would, yeah.
Yes, I agree. I think if it had come out in the cinema like it was intended to, it may have got a little bit lost because it's a very small, quiet film. But I think now coming out on various digital platforms, if you put this on a Friday night with your tea, I think you would really enjoy it. And, you know, it's a lovely little film.
And we're in those sort of dog days of summer are just about to come.
Yeah.
So we can all relate to the ice cream van and other things that are in the film. Okay, so that's Days of Bagnall's Summer, which is available on all digital platforms from Monday the 8th of June. And we'll be talking to Simon Bird about it on next week's podcast, so do come back for that. Okay, so let's stay with teenagers then and take a look at this.
What the hell are you doing? You're gay.
I'm gay for boobs. I'm not gay.
Yes, you are. So am I. We pretend to go out just until school is over. We're going to Dublin.
Okay, so that's Dating Amber. Jordan, where do we find our protagonists in this one?
Yeah, so this is set in 1995 in a small village in Ireland. It's a high school comedy about Eddie and Amber. They're two 17-year-olds not far off graduating from high school and going off to, you know, university or college, or in Eddie's case, to sort of a military boot camp, but more on that later. Throughout their entire sort of time at school, they've been teased, bullied over the fact that they've never had romantic partners. And there's a good reason for this, because they're both gay. At the end of their school life, they're both sick of the fact that they're this nonstop teasing. So Eddie and Amber come up with this plan to date one another, to essentially be each other's beards and, you know, stave off the ridicule from the rest of their classmates and get a lot of praise for the fact that, you know, they're no longer single, they're no longer lame. But things start to get a bit tricky when Eddie seemingly starts to develop some kind of feelings for Amber. And I quite like this. There's a great idea underpinning this. It's sort of a really inventive, classical, romantic comedy kind of setup. But the great thing is that the main characters can never be truly attracted to each other in the way that they would be in a normal romantic comedy. And there are moments where it really works. Eddie is really struggling with being a closeted gay man. This is complicated by the fact that his father is something of a military hero, and is sort of pressuring Eddie into following his footsteps and joining the military himself. So it's dealing with some serious stuff, but at the same time, it is quite sweet and funny.
You've made that sound more serious. It is actually like properly laugh out loud funny, isn't it? I mean, like, there's some corkers of lines in this and some great put downs by Lola Pettigrew as Amber. So if you've come to the end of Normal People, this might fill a gap, because it's obviously, you know, the romantic entanglements of school kids in Ireland. And it does star Fionn O'Shea, who plays Jamie in Normal People. Very different character here, though. He's so sweet and awkward and funny in this. Not at all like the horrible Jamie in Normal People. So I just really enjoyed watching him do something very different as well in this. Did you enjoy it, Jamie?
I did like it. I don't think it's going to change the world. But again, I think it's a very, just a nice little film that's a good watch. And like you said, it's funny. I think the first half hour, it starts off as more of a comedy and then it gradually kind of becomes more serious as it goes on. But it's got some great lines. There's one moment when Amber, she meets a student girl in, like, I think they go to Dublin to a gay club, which is like a big deal for them, their first sort of big night out. And she meets this student girl and they start dating. And she says to this girl, like, does your mum know, you know, that you're gay? And she says, oh, Jesus, no, you know, she'd order an exorcism if she did. And there's just loads of lines like that, just sort of one-liners that are funny. I thought both of the leads were very good in it. Being set in 1995 is key, that the film kind of opens with news audio about AIDS, about the troops returning from Lebanon, about various religious matters. And it doesn't kind of really underline these points, but throughout the films, you know, you see crucifixes on walls, you know, inside houses. There's someone handing out leaflets saying vote no for divorce. So you really get a sense of that kind of time in Ireland. And, you know, just how difficult for all teenagers. It's so hard growing up and finding your identity and being true to yourself with everyone around you teasing you and all of that. But, you know, in mid-90s Ireland, with just how repressed a lot of it could be, you know, it must have been quite horrific to be gay in those times growing up, you know, in a school with everyone hounding you.
Indeed. There's some lovely performances as well from supporting actors. Sharon Horgan's in it as his mum. She has a really lovely scene towards the end, and I would have liked to have seen more of her, actually. I thought the parents were sort of underwritten, but I understand that it's obviously the film about the kids, so there's a good reason for that. But I really did enjoy her, and I would have liked to have seen more. And I also thought it reminded me a bit of sort of Love, Simon, in the sort of light touch way it dealt with this, and the way that it actually could be a really useful and empowering and make you feel good about yourself movie for any kids that are sort of struggling with these sort of issues. Any school memories do you want to contribute to this one, Jamie?
I have many school memories, Jane, but that would be telling, and we'll save it for the next podcast, maybe.
Okay. That'll be for our offshoot podcast, which is On the Couch with Jamie. Okay, so are we recommending Dating Amber as a little warm, cosy, sweet film that might just scratch that normal people itch?
Yeah, I would say if you're looking for the next normal people, this probably isn't it. But if you got along with something like Netflix's Sex Education, it's sort of more in line with that. If you enjoyed that, there's every chance you'll enjoy this.
I agree with Jordan. I think he just summed it up perfectly. Normal people to me is something very, very special and several rungs above this. But Sex Education is a really good reference point, and I think it's well worth checking out. So yeah, I'd recommend this one.
Okay, so that's Dating Amber, which is on Amazon Prime from Thursday, the 4th of June. So it's available today. So seeing as this podcast has been a festival of youth and Jamie's memories, let's see how much you know about teen movies. It's quiz time, boys. And she doesn't give a damn about me. 'Cause I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. Yeah, I'm just a teenage dirtbag, baby. So this is not another teen movie quiz. And are we going to start off with Jamie or Jordan with these queries?
Jordan.
All right, so number one, Jordan. The 2008 adaptation of Angus Thongs and Full Frontal Snogging changed the full frontal bit to what? Was it perfect, full on, or super duper?
I don't know if I'm embarrassed or proud to know this, but it's perfect.
It is. I don't know how you know that, because I did not.
I have a weirdly vivid memory of that film. Don't know why. Didn't even like it that much.
I'm sure the version I saw was called Full Frontal Snogging. Maybe I saw a press screening before they changed the title. I don't know. But it was definitely Full Frontal.
And it was the... well,
was it?
Oh, was it? I think maybe you're watching a different version altogether.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay, so number two, Jamie. Which Mike Leigh film shares its title with one of the Bring It On sequels? Is it Secrets and Lies, All or Nothing, or High Hopes?
I know this, Jane, because I'm a massive Mike Leigh fan and I'm a massive Bring It On fan as well. These are
that
the
is
twin...
true. You are not lying. You do love
it. Yeah, the twin pillars of cinema for me here. So it is All or Nothing.
It is. You are correct. All right, Jordan. At what age was Boys in the Hood helmer John Singleton when he became the youngest person ever to be nominated for Best Director? Was it 20 years old, 24, or 26?
I'm sure it's not 20. I'm sure he was mid-20s. I have a feeling it was 24. Yeah, I'll go 24.
You are correct. So another point for you. Jamie, who sings the title song in Greece? Is it John Travolta, Frankie Avalon, or Frankie Valli?
Well, I should know this one, Jane, because before I used to lie in my bedroom listening to heavy metal, like Days of Bagnold Summer, I used to lie in my bedroom listening to the Grease soundtrack again and again and again. So it's Frankie Valli.
It is, correct. And that's another little image for me to think about you. Okay, you Jordan. Dope actor Shameik Moore went on to star in which 2018 teen picture? Blockers, Eighth Grade, or Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse? If you don't know this, really.
This is the thing. I almost feel like this is a trick question because it's so easy. Now I'm trying to think, am I going to trip myself up here? he's definitely in Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse because he plays Miles Morales. And I'm pretty sure he's not in the other two. So yeah, let's go Spider-Verse.
Correct. That would have been a major embarrassment had you got that wrong, right? With your love of that film. Okay, Jamie, the original Battle Royale was made in which year? 2000, 2002, or 2003?
Ooh. I remember, I mean, it came out on Tartan Extreme, I think they were called back in the day. I used to get all of their videos, DVDs, brought loads of great directors to these shores. I would say it's probably the earliest of those. In my mind, it's kind of very 90s. It would have been 99. So obviously it's not that. So I'll go for 2000.
Correct. And yet another little look into your life.
Yes, okay. A lot of extreme horror.
Yes. And Jordan, which member of the Breakfast Club cameos in Not Another Teen Movie? Is it Ali Sheedy, Judd Nelson, or Molly Ringwald?
I have never seen Not Another Teen Movie. I've seen The Breakfast Club, obviously. Guess Judd Nelson.
It's not. It's lovely Molly Ringwald, so no points for you.
What were you thinking, Molly?
Jamie, Mean Girls director Mark Waters is the brother of Daniel Waters, who directed which other teen classic? Is it Pump Up the Volume, Heathers, or Risky Business?
At the risk of giving you more insight to my youth, I used to watch Heathers quite a lot, so I know it's Heathers. At least I'm pretty sure it's Heathers, but can I get a bonus point for some Risky Business? No, this is good, because Paul Brickman was the director of Risky Business, and I know this because the film came out in 1983, it got rave reviews, it did really well at the box office, and then he only ever made one more film in 1990, I think it was. I can't remember the title of it, but I always thought that was really odd that it was his debut, writer-director, got all of his raves, and then, you know, never really did much after that. Such a shame. But anyway, Heathers, and I would like a bonus point if I can, but there you go.
No, that's not how this works. No, but thanks for the intel. It was good. Okay. I didn't know that, so there we go. Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah. All right, Jordan. Kirsten Dunst, or is she Kirsten? It's Kirsten, I think we have to say.
Kirsten
Dunst starred in Get Over It, and it's a loose adaptation of which Shakespeare play? A Midsummer Night's Dream, Much Ado About Nothing, or Taming of the Shrew?
I'm pretty sure this is A Midsummer Night's Dream.
Correct. Well done. Okay, Jamie.
Yeah.
In Love, Simon, which you mentioned earlier, who plays Simon? Is it Brenton Thwaites, Nick Robinson, or Josh Hutcherson?
It's Nick Robinson. And yeah, I got a bit lucky there because you're doing questions alternately. There was at least one of Jordan's I didn't know the answer of, but I fluked it with the order. I know this one's so Nick Robinson.
Correct. Jamie is a flyaway winner there. I'm sorry, Jordan.
He's clearly more in touch with his teenage self than
I am. He really is. And we know this to be true when we work with him in the office.
Okay. I've never stopped talking about it yet.
No. Okay. So we don't want to hear anything more about mini golf or any of those other things you tell us all the time. It's time to say goodbye. But Jordan, what percentage can you get off Total Film subscriptions with the code INSIDETF at checkout when you go to www.myfavouritemagazines.co.uk?
You can get a whopping 10% off.
10%, and that is not to be sniffed at.
Well, we're subscribing this month because if you subscribe now, you'll get our Tenant issue as part of your subscription.
World
and that issue
exclusive.
Is not to be missed.
It is not to be missed. 14 pages of Christopher Nolan head muddling weirdness that you're just like, what's going on? It's amazing. Okay, so on that note, I think we'll say thank you, Jamie. Go and have a little lie down.
I'm going
maybe
to
do meditation or something. And Jordan,
listen to some Grease.
Yeah, yeah, go and listen to your Grease album again.
Grease and some heavy metal straight after.
Yeah, and Jordan, you can go and get on with your work.
Oh, it's not fair.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, and we'll see you next week. Say goodbye, boys.
Thank you. Bye.
See you next time.